Douglas is one of many who found a new life through Seattle's Union Gospel Mission.
I was living on the streets when I heard this guy talk about how he got clean and sober at the mission. So I decided to give it a try. I could feel something working inside of me, and I knew I was getting better. Today, my number one goal is to stay clean and sober.
And grace will lead me home.
To hear more, volunteer, or donate, visit UGM.org.
You are listening to KLRN Radio, where liberty and reason still reign.
To protect his home and family from disaster, Steve used courage, wisdom, and his camera phone.
That should do it.
Way to go, Steve! By simply taking digital pictures of his family's important documents, Steve can always have them stored safely online, no matter when disaster strikes. Learn other simple ways to protect your home and family before a natural disaster at ready.gov. That's ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
It's Sunday night on KLRN Radio, America's podcast network. Welcome to In the Crease. I am your host, J-E-double-F. It's time to call up Mulder, notify the lone gunman, and drop that puck on cultural pseudoscience and conspiracy theories.
The following program may contain coarse language, adult themes, and bad attempts at humor. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, it's an In the Crease show. People were starting to wonder if maybe they had some sort of Mandela effect on the show was real or not. Sorry about that. Bit of a health issue and then a vacation around the weeks I would normally have released in ITC made that nay impossible to do. So my apologies. I will say that it did allow me some time to catch up on some projects that have sat dormant for far too long, and even somehow managed to catch up on my audiobook still in my library. It also allowed me a lot of time to figure out where I want to go with In the Crease in the future, or rather future episodes. And as we are sitting here at episode 35, we are close to that magical 42nd episode I've been dying to do. Oh, can't wait to 42. Until such time, I thought I would combine a few recent books, or mainly just really one, I have either read or listened to in the recent weeks. The most recent one that I've listened to is Pseudoscience and Science Fiction by Andrew May. In the book, he talks about science fiction, pseudoscience, and a little bit about science itself. Now, Dr. May is a former scientist with an MA from Cambridge University and a PhD in astrophysics from Manchester University. After a 30-year career spanning the academic, government, and private sectors, he has now settled in the southwest of England, where he works as a freelance writer and consultant on subjects as diverse as defense technology, history, physics, Fortiana, and New Age beliefs. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, or perhaps even the other one I do, Lost Wonder, you will know I am a fan of all three subject matters, and even would throw myself into maybe even the ancient astronaut theorist category on a few of the things. One thing I have learned in my many years on this planet, and, you know, a couple here and there on another, is that give everyone a listen until they prove themselves to be completely unlistenable or that much of a dumbass. Now, Andrew May brings up some very interesting subjects in this book, some honestly I had never thought of prior, and some I would argue vehemently with him on. He did provoke a lot of thoughts and ideas in my head, which is always a good day, even if my head is very crowded lately. Also, for regular listeners of In the Crease, I hope you enjoy this ride, as I hope to take you in a direction you may not expect. Most of all, I hope you find yourself shaking your head in agreement with Dr. May. Sadly, this Dr. May is not the one that played guitar for Queen, although I still need to read his books. Now, nodding maybe even with me, but maybe a chance shaking your head in disagreement and coming up with your own ideas that are brought forth during this show. Now let's get into the meat of it. And some of this will sound like an episode of Juxtaposition. Sorry if I'm stepping on your toes, Amish. In the book, there is talk of time slips, which, honestly, time travel and time slips is a major pet peeve of mine, the Philadelphia Experiment, Tunguska, Bermuda Triangle, high-tech paranoia, flying saucers, mind powers, space drives, which you know I love talking about that, anti-gravity, technology of aliens, and conspiracy theories. And I would be remiss if I did not recommend the audio version of this over the physical book itself. The narrator, Stephen Crossley, makes it sound like you were actually listening to actual recordings from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on many of these subjects. I swear to you, you listen to it and you're going, holy shit, you know, it's the actual guide. But anyway, and I have more on time travel that I'll maybe touch on another episode because I do love talking about that. As Philadelphia Experiment, Tunguska, Bermuda Triangle, high-tech paranoia are matters that not only would Rick and Ordy cover on Juxtaposition, Al would also cover on one of his shows. So I will mostly skip on those matters. So let's jump right in to something called the flying saucer phenomena. Science fiction has always had a close association and an ongoing two-way dialogue with the subject of UFOs, unidentified flying objects, or the new one they throw around, the UAPs, while presumed to be an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Many of the established elements of UFOlogy made an appearance in the works of fiction before they were reported in the real world, and several important authors of nonfiction UFO books started their careers in sci-fi. Subjects like extraterrestrial life and advanced alien civilizations are not unknown to mainstream scientists, but the latter tend to talk about them in a way that is significantly different and offer much less, quote, human interest, unquote, than their UFOlogy or science fiction counterparts. When Charles Fort died in 1932, terms like UFO and flying saucer had not yet been coined. Nevertheless, as his biographer Damon Knight pointed out, Fort's books are full of reports of strange phenomena, similar in every way of today's reports on flying saucers, but centuries before they were called flying saucers. As seen in Charles Fort and the Fortians, Fort also speculated on the possible extraterrestrial origins of such objects. In his second book, New Lands, he wrote of ships from other worlds that have been seen by millions of the inhabitants of the Earth exploring night after night in the skies of France, England, New England, and Canada. The original audience for Fort's books were minuscule, limited to a small band of dedicated Fortians, as well as a few science fiction readers and writers like Richard Shaver and Ray Palmer. The latter was quick to cite Fort rather than Shaver as the progenitor of the extraterrestrial hypothesis in response to a skeptical comment from a reader in the September 1946 issue of Amazing Stories. Palmer wrote, "As for spaceships, you may say Shaver did not originate that, nor are readers. Ever read the books of Charles Fort? He's the culprit, if anyone is. Personally, we believe these ships do visit the Earth. Now, 9 months after these words appeared, the whole world suddenly found itself talking about mysterious objects in the sky. The flying saucer craze had started, and it was triggered by just a single sighting. In itself, this was not very different from the hundreds of previous cases discussed by Fort and Palmer. For some strange reason, however, it made headlines around the globe. In the words of UFO researcher Jenny Randles, the UFO mystery officially began on June 24, 1947, when American pilot Kenneth Arnold had a close encounter above the Cascade Mountain Range in Washington, USA. While flying across the northwestern states on a routine business trip, Arnold's attention was caught by a flash in the afternoon sky. After ensuring that it was not a reflection off the canopy of his small aircraft, he watched in astonishment as a formation of crescent-like objects streaked across his path. As an experienced pilot, Arnold was able to judge their speed and knew that they were traveling much faster than any aircraft that he knew about. At the time, Arnold concluded that the objects he had seen must have been secret American aircraft on training flight. However, his brief report to ground control created more fuss than he imagined. When he reached his destination in Yakima, he was greeted by journalists eager to hear his amazing story. It was a slow news day, and Arnold offered the perfect antidote. Now, in the immediate aftermath of Kenneth Arnold's sighting, newspapers found themselves inundated with hundreds of copycat reports from across America and around the world. Some of these incidents occurred in the weeks following Arnold's encounter, while others were backdated accounts, like those collected by Charles Fort, that had received little publicity at the time they actually allegedly occurred. A noteworthy point in Jenny Randall's foregoing account in the description of the objects Arnold saw as crescent-like rather than saucer-shaped. The fact is that Arnold was ambiguous on the point. In his first official report on the incident, written less than 3 weeks later on 12th of July, he did indeed refer to them as saucer-like disc. On other occasions, however, he used phrases like semicircular, crescent-shaped, or even bat-winged, and maintained that he used the word saucer not to describe their shape, but how they moved, like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water. Now, whatever shape it was that Arnold saw, subsequent UFO sightings throughout the late 40s and into the 50s and 60s were overwhelmingly saucer-shaped. Science fiction followed suit. Prior to then, sci-fi writers and artists had usually envisioned alien spacecraft as being cylindrical in shape, similar to such as a rocket or a submarine. However, the saucer shape was not unknown in science fiction, even as far back as 1920. Menace of the Saucers reads almost like UFOlogy metafiction. Its protagonist is a sci-fi writer named Thane Smith, who has always been outspokenly skeptical about UFOs until, at the start of his novel, he has a close encounter of his own. The text is filled with real-world reports of the kind found in many non-fiction UFO books, and Thane experiences for himself many of the oddest features of such reports. He gradually learns the logic behind seemingly illogical observations such as the saucer's defiance of the known laws of physics, the enormous variation in descriptions of their occupants, and the near impossibility of obtaining any kind of firm proof of their existence. 2 years after Menace of the Saucers, Binder produced a sequel, Night of the Saucers. This second novel sees Thane Smith making a return to skeptical UFO debunking as zealously as ever. This is not because he is once again a non-believer, but because he knows the full truth about UFOs and knows that the truth needs to be concealed at all cost. Now, Otto Binder was a fiction writer who switched to non-fiction UFOlogy, then back to fiction.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
In order to proselytize his views on the UFO conspiracy, exactly the same pattern cropped up again 2 decades later in the case of much more famous author Whitley Strieber. Strieber first hit the headlines in 1987 with his nonfiction book Communion, although by that time he was already well established as a writer of fiction. Over the previous decade, he had produced a steady stream of horror novels, which were successful, but not outstandingly so. By contrast, Communion, subtitled A True Story, was a worldwide bestseller. In harrowing detail, it described Strieber's own personal alien abduction experience. Thanks to widespread newspaper and TV coverage of Strieber's book, this previously little-known aspect of UFOlogy suddenly reached a global audience. Now, 2 years after Communion, Strieber returned to fiction in 1989 with a science fiction novel called Majestic. In the acknowledgments at the start of the book, the author describes it as a work of fiction based on fact. Very much the same terms people like Eric Frank Russell had used to describe his seminal novel Sinister Barrier 50 years earlier. Just as Russell had done, Strieber explained that he was presenting his narrative in fictional form in order to protect himself from reprisals from the authorities. He claimed that a lawyer friend had advised him that your only hope is to publish your book as fiction. They'll figure if they hit you, it tells the world it's all true. Now, the focal point of Strieber's novel is a real historical event, albeit one that is subject to multiple interpretations. This is the so-called Roswell incident of July 8, 1947, just 2 weeks after Kenneth Arnold's original sighting, when a flying disc was reported to have crashed near the military airbase in Roswell, New Mexico. After an initial flurry in the world's media, the crashed object was soon dismissed as a weather balloon and forgotten. The event was hardly ever mentioned by UFOlogists until 1980, when a book was published on the subject, The Roswell Incident by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. This book, followed by a stream of further quote-unquote eyewitnesses and their revelations, transformed the Roswell Incident into the world's best-known UFO case, complete with crashed saucer, recovered alien bodies, reverse-engineered technology, and a massive government cover-up. Around 1984, members of the UFO community became aware of a set of supposedly top-secret documents that appeared to blow the lid off the Roswell case. These documents concerned a top-level government team called Majestic 12, which had allegedly been set up in the wake of the Roswell crash. It is the historical background to these documents that Strieber portrays in his novel, Majestic. Yet again, we have a situation where an author claims that a book, presented in the form of fiction, is actually based on solid fact. Yet, the supposed quote-unquote fact in question, the existence of the Majestic 12 group, is itself almost certainly fictitious. As for Fortean investigator Mark Pilkington discovered, the first of the documents mentioning it was a fake and not very convincing one to those who knew what they were looking for. Now, later documents building on that shaky start appear to have been tailored not for an official government audience, but for the UFO community. Any community that bases its philosophy on the mantra, I want to believe, is going to be relatively easy to dupe. Whether the Majestic 12 documents were a random act of mischief-making by what today would be referred to as trolls, or part of a more deliberate disinformation campaign, it is still relatively unknown on this matter. And fascinating, this cultural interpretation of UFOs go much further. For the late 1970s, a new UFO type started to be seen. Huge, black triangles were often seen hovering over roads in cities. Curiously, a majority of these reports started to occur after 1977. What happened in 1977? Well, George Lucas, or rather the person he stole the screenplay from, had a movie that was viewed by mass audience. Now, in that movie, what was the opening scene? Yes, large triangle-shaped starships. And I have to admit, the timing of this is highly sus, and the proof of specific shapes and encounters are largely presented with a corresponding entertainment value. Also, from the 70s, the Greys started to rise in popularity of abductions and the like, thanks in large part to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now, some will say Close Encounters in Star Wars, which were both in 77, led to a huge upsurge in interest in this sort of thing. A survey carried out in America that year found that 57% of respondents believed that UFOs were real, while 7% claimed to have seen one themselves. In 1978, Britain's Ministry of Defense received no fewer than 750 reports of UFO sightings, the largest number there have ever been. Now, my scientific and logical brain cannot pass that all off as mere coincidence, even if I hope it was, you know, just that. And it really does get worse. Before there were gray aliens and triangular ships, there was the famous alien sex encounters. Now, I really don't want to go into a lengthy DNA conversation, but alien-human fucking is not going to necessarily produce offspring easily. Yes, with the help of genome splicing and the like, you could take place in maybe test tubes and things of that nature, and some magic weaved in there. Now, the first sexually explicit UFO encounter occurred in 1957, after a flying saucer appeared over the field where Brazilian farm worker Antonio Villas Boas was working. The engine of his tractor cut out, and space-suited aliens emerged to take him inside the craft. Villas Boas was stripped, subjected to a brief medical examination, and then left alone with an equally naked alien female. Without saying a word, she mounted him and proceeded to copulate with him in an interspecies sex session, during which, and I quote, she growled like a dog. I mean, who hasn't been there? For Villas Boas, the experience seems to have been a pleasurable one. The same is true of a number of other people, both male and female, who reported close encounters of the sexual kind during the ensuing decades. For example, American jazz singer Pamela Stonebrook claimed intimacy with a reptilian alien. He just appeared in my bedroom and began making love to me. The sex was incredible. It was like everything you wanted it to be. There was a telepathic communication, and I felt totally connected to this being. You sense the vibration. Our bodies merge. Your whole body has an orgasm. It's not just localized. It's a total merging of energy and spirit. Many ufologists assume the purpose of human-alien sex, whether consensual or not, is to produce hybrid offspring. This may seem a reasonable assertion to someone who is ignoring facts of genetics, but from a scientific point of view, it is actually highly ludicrous. Human beings share 98.8% of their DNA with chimpanzees, yet the two species cannot interbreed to produce hybrid offspring. A species from another planet would be more distantly related to Homo sapiens, not only more so than not only with a chimpanzee, but than any other terrestrial species from an earthworm to an elephant. Despite its impossibility, the idea of human-alien hybrids has become deeply ingrained in popular culture. Now, I know what you are saying. 98.8% is close, but it still leaves a 1.2% range. Sorry, there is math in this show. I should have warned you beforehand. Granted, a lot of the factors like chromosome sets, shared DNA, and the like play a major factor. Even at 99.99% shared DNA, it does not necessarily mean reproduction is possible. The protein pairs between the sperm and the ovum would decide if it is feasible or not. But advanced medical capabilities could help in some of these, if not many, of these areas. So I don't want to necessarily poo-poo this as a possibility, something the author kind of does, though his arguments are solid from many aspects. By the way, this book is full of footnotes. It is a well-researched book. So from that point of view, I absolutely love it, even if I probably disagreed with maybe a third of what he wrote in the book. Don't let that as an argument of not getting it. It's actually, in many ways, interesting because of that. But what I find intriguing is the correlation the author presents, though I wish I had more time to research if there were instances of sightings before these cultural influences on the sightings. I want to say probably 90% of me agrees with Dr. May here that a lot of the cultural influence of UFOs and the sightings and aliens are brought on by either, you know, books, TV, radio, movies, and things like that. But 10% of me wants to say, embrace the power of and. But it's not just me, I hope. Now, the sex with earthlings, besides something, you know, well, I wouldn't mind doing right now, is one that has gained a lot of traction in the recent years. Besides the DNA avenue that can reveal a lot of minute differences, but perhaps it is the ancient astronaut theory that has kicked that up even another notch. And I'm going to switch to that, I think. One of the all-time bestsellers of ufology was the book Flying Saucers Have Landed in 1953, co-written by Desmond Leslie and George Adamski, something like that, sorry, which sold over a million copies during the 1950s. It is really two books in one. The first, two-thirds, is a theoretical speculation on the nature of UFOs by Leslie, and the last third is Adamski's first-hand account on his own encounters with flying saucers. The latter was the reason for the book's popularity, although with hindsight, the former may have actually been more interesting. Desmond Leslie was a fascinating individual. He is, and maybe was, I don't know if he's dead or not, sorry, a cousin of the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and he served as a fighter pilot during World War II. Later, he became interested in mysticism and the occult, and wrote novels and screenplays, including a now largely forgotten sci-fi B-movie called Stranger from Venus, released in 1954. But it is perhaps only one name that most conjure up when you mention ancient astronauts, and that is Eric von Däniken. Now, some may also go to Giorgio Tsoukalos, but most people, it's still Eric von Däniken. The truth is, however, that it is a well-established idea long before von Däniken wrote his first book on the subject, Chariot of the Gods, in 68. Besides the writings of Desmond Leslie and Arthur Orton already mentioned, the idea was alluded by veteran science fiction author Eric Frank Russell in the nonfiction book Great World Mysteries back in 62. Anything strange seen soaring above the clouds automatically became a fiery chariot. Some imaginative writers have seized on this fact and turned out stories depicting biblical characters as enlightened visitors from another world. Powell's and Bergier's seminal New Age classic, The Morning of the Magicians, which was discussed earlier in the book and goes into more detail, also hints at the ancient astronaut theory. In a recent study, Professor Agreste, who accepts the hypothesis of the Earth having been visited long ago by interplanetary travelers, relates his discovery among the first texts introduced into the Bible by Jewish priests of reference.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Says to beings from another world who, like Enoch, disappeared into the heavens of mysterious ark-like vessels. Paul's and Bergier's book first appeared in France in 1960. So why is Eric von Däniken so much better known than the various ancient astronaut theorists who preceded him? Well, we'll explore that right after the break.
They travel to the world on a silvery light. The people of the earth stood waiting, watching as the ships came one by one, setting fire to the sky as they landed, carrying to the world children of the sun. Children of the sun.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
This fall, Inspiration 4 launches as the first all-civilian mission to space. And you could be on board.
Up above.
Visit inspiration4.com for your chance to go to space.
Dealing with COVID-19 is uncharted territory, and everyone has different challenges. People may feel anxious, down, or overwhelmed. For some, these feelings can lead to changes in sleep patterns, an increased use of alcohol or drugs, or withdrawing from the people around them. If you know someone who's having a hard time coping, you can help by reaching out to talk and listen. To learn more about how you can help someone in need, call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-TALK.
Welcome back for the rest of the story. Eric Von Däniken may be best known, in large part, than his predecessors contented themselves with just reinterpreting dusty old texts, while Von Däniken went out in search of mysterious relics like a latter-day Indiana Jones. Pseudo-archaeology is far more appealing than pseudo-history. Now, that is not me saying pseudo-archaeology, but rather taken directly from the author himself. And this is the part of the book where you can really see his dislike of the subject matter he is covering. And I strongly have issues with the word pseudo-archaeology. Pseudo-archaeology, also known as alternate archaeology, fringe archaeology, fantastic archaeology, cult archaeology, and spooky archaeology, refers to interpretations of the past from outside the archaeological science community, which reject the accepted data gathering and analytic methods of the discipline. They reject the accepted methods. So, because someone happens to think outside the box, it is pseudo-anything. Like I said, I sort of prescribe to the ancient astronaut theory myself, and perhaps I will find time to give a detailed account on my belief on that matter with a future episode. But everything I say after here that has kind of any mean connotations are most likely from the author, unless it is directed at the author, then it's definitely coming from me. The first item up for debate is the famous tomb lid in Palenque, Mexico, of the astronaut in the ship. Of it, Von Däniken writes, "Could primitive imagination have produced anything so remarkably similar to a modern astronaut in his rocket? Those strange markings at the foot of the drawing can only be an indication of the flames and gases coming from the propulsion unit." Now, in a rebuttal to Von Däniken's theories entitled The Space Gods Revealed, Ronald Story points out that the tomb in question belongs to a well-documented king named Pakal, who lived from 603 to 683 CE. He suggests the carving is a stylized depiction of the king himself, which would be interpreted in the context of other Mayan artwork of the period rather than modern-day culture. On top of that, Van Däniken's interpretation does not stand up to close scrutiny, according to them. The quote-unquote spacecraft is rather small, with few outer protections for the rider. Of greater concern is the fact that the astronaut has his head protruding outside the rocket. It's also strange that the figure is barefoot and does not wear gloves. Both fingernails and toenails are actually illustrated, and has a complicated helmet which does not cover his face. Except for a breechcloth and typical Mayan jade anklets, bracelets and necklace, and the helmet on his head, our astronaut is basically naked. Now, in spite of objections such as this, Von Däniken's theories remain popular to this day. To some extent, this is a reflection of the extraterrestrial worldview that has been ingrained on modern culture, both by ufology and science fiction. This homage, if that is what it can be called, is not always appreciated. As science fiction critic Peter Nichols puts out, most science fiction writers regard the adoptions of the notions by such people as Von Däniken as a travesty, which is bad on the reputation of their art. Now, I had to laugh at the scrutiny bit. Not because I vehemently disagree with the take that the Mayan artwork does not represent an astronaut, but the fact that few outer protections for the rider are shown, or no face covering. Well, no shit. Hey, everyone here, you know, it's like how the astronauts fit and operate inside the Dragon capsule for SpaceX. You had to draw an image of how they fit. But you know what? I'm not going to draw how they look inside. I'm just going to draw, you know, the outside of the damn thing, because, you know, that's the outer covering, you know. And has anyone ever tried to draw glass? It's not easy to draw glass. So anyway, so you can tell that the author is just starting to rev up his little bit of vitriol for Däniken and anyone that remotely thinks he could remotely have some truth to be told. He continues, "In fact, the archaeological evidence put forth by Von Däniken and his followers would make far from convincing science fiction. The artifacts they draw attention to are often primitively made and ambiguous as to interpretation. Two often cited examples are the Saqqara glider from Egypt and the Baghdad battery from Iraq, both dating from around 2 millennia ago. However, the former is made of wood and the size of a small bird. At best, it is a scale model of a very simple, unpowered flying machine. The latter, if it really is a battery, would, as Ronald Story pointed out, be the most primitive form of simple cell possible, hardly the product of advanced alien technology. When alien artifacts are dug up in science fiction, they tend to be far more impressive. The Hammer film Quatermass in the Pit begins with the unearthing of a Martian spacecraft buried beneath London for 5 million years in the same archaeological stratum as Fossil Ape Man. The film was released in 67, the year before Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods, but an earlier version has been serialized on British television in previous decades. So yeah, I'm going to go a little bit on the defense here, but stating that any ancient alien stuff we find should be more like the cultural movies tell us to find, that doesn't sound scientific at all. But I want to touch on that battery thing for a moment. The experiments done with this simple single battery has shown it produces 1.5 to 2 volts and could be strung together to generate more. At the time of their creation, electric fish were used for some treatments, and perhaps this device could be used to electroplate some items as well. But do you know how many volts are needed to charge your iPhone? 2.5 to 5 volts. Granted, you need an amp, one single amp, and the Baghdad battery only produced anywhere from 100 to 400 microamps, well short of the 1 million microamps you needed. So yeah, not great. And we all have made jokes about going back in time, you know, and buying IBM, Amazon, Bitcoin, when they were dirt cheap. Can you imagine going back 2,000 years with what you have in your pocket right now, provided you're wearing pants, which, knowing this audience, now, what could you create going back that 2,000 years from memory? Or, say you have your iPhone with you, how long would it last with your music or books that you could use for research? I think, and though it is not stated anywhere, the author thinks the astronauts came and went. With a fair number of theories, which a fair number of theories Däniken and that hair man do push forward as they came and went. But the stories of those left behind could actually be far more fascinating. So I will politely disagree with Dr. May here a bit on some of this, but the next subject is one I have thought for years was just a bit of trick photography, shadows and the like. So you can say I kind of agree with them going into it. And I would be remiss if I did not mention Stargate in any episode of In the Crease. The 1994 film Stargate begins with the discovery of a strange artifact in the Egyptian desert. At first sight, the object is unusual, but not necessarily alien, having the form of a large stone ring adorned with hieroglyphs and other symbols. Only much later is it found to be a highly advanced piece of technology, the portal to an interplanetary wormhole of the type described previously in other episodes. It turns out the Stargate was placed on Earth in ancient Egyptian times by a humanoid extraterrestrial who was worshipped as the sun god Ra. Now, in many ways, the scenario portrayed in Stargate echoes that of Pyramids of Mars, a 1975 episode of the TV series Doctor Who. Here, the ancient alien took the form of the god Sutek, rather than Ra. While the entrance to the wormhole was located inside an Egyptian sarcophagus, though later leads not to a planet in another solar system as in the Stargate, but to a pyramid-like structure on Mars, where Sutek was imprisoned by his fellow aliens. One year, after Pyramid of Mars was broadcast, NASA's spacecraft Viking 1 entered orbit around Mars and began collecting the first high-resolution images of the planet's surface. By coincidence, some of the images from a region called Cydonia did indeed show pyramid-like structures as well as other objects, which, to a casual observer, looks as if they might have been artificially made. The official view is that these are all examples of pareidolia, a well-known psychological effect which causes the brain to see familiar objects in random patterns. Not surprisingly, pseudoscientists and conspiracy theorists remain unconvinced by this explanation. As Fortean writer Mark Pilkington puts it, through some fantastical over-interpretation by zealous mytho-archaeologists, wow, he's trying to use big words here to make us feel small, the Cydonian structures were soon being connected to human secret sites as Avebury, the Stone Circle, and the pyramids and Sphinx at Giza in Egypt. Did I mention he really seems to dislike people that think this way? I will try to drop this picture in chat. Yes, the higher resolution photo does look less blatant of that of a face, but I have to say, I am not 100% persuaded by his argument, and I already came into this thinking it was just shadows. That said, seeing the higher resolution, I see far too many perfect curves and baselines that are just out of the blue. He may have inadvertently made me switch camps here. Some people think the face is bona fide evidence of life on Mars, evidence that NASA would rather hide, say conspiracy theorists. Meanwhile, defenders of the NASA budget wish there was an ancient civilization on Mars. Okay, that was a bit of a good comment. Kudos to him on that. NASA would love to say, hey, give us even more money because life on Mars, and not just like on the Wong family farm. As the book progresses, he starts dropping the conspiracy theorist name like Politibunny drops the dumbass name on me. I get the vibe that in a red pill, blue pill crowd, he is not only blue pill, but he wants to take like two or three of them. Okay, and that might be a little bit harsh, but here's the thing. It is not like conspiracy theorists have never gotten it right. Yes, there are a lot of odd conspiracy theorists that make you scratch your head in major, major disbelief. Hell, KLRN Radio's own Al of Circumspice Right Side of Michigan, the show that follows this one, offered up about a year ago this strange theory that the plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan was probably a likely FBI setup. Can you imagine that? Wait. Yeah, being told by my executive producer that Al was right? Whoops. Now, the thing that bugs me is often good-minded individuals feel when something is off. Intelligent people can sniff out tangents of said events. It doesn't make them right. It doesn't make them wrong. It is what I truly think that at the core ancient astronaut theorists are, or at least I am, and want people to look at things just in a different way. Though Heisenberg's uncertainty principle may be for quantum mechanics and the math involved, but I think it has a ring of truth in principle. And I know I may have turned you off, some of you off on from the show, but I hope you stayed. And you may be asking, where am I going with this now? Well, most of the show has been about UFOs, ancient aliens, and the like, but also about how culture has, in many cases, predated and predated a change in attitudes in these certain things, contrary to what the author would go on to talk about with predictive programming and how he largely scoffs at it. I cannot and will not scoff at any of it. We can be trained to see things or not see things. Hell, just ask 20 people at a crime scene to describe a shooter that was at the scene. You will most likely get 20 different answers. Which one is the truth? Unless you have actual evidence, none of them are, but none of them are necessarily lying. More importantly, though, people see patterns that others do not. To that, conspiracy theorists are not necessarily nut jobs. In fact, there are numerous examples of conspiracy theories that turned out to be true. So can we immediately crap on the guy in the pickup truck with his god-awful southern accent as being an FBI plant? No, we can't. Why? Well, here is a list of sometimes a conspiracy turned out to be true. First up, Canada tried to develop Gaydar. Conspiracy. The Canada government was so paranoid about homosexuality that it developed a Gaydar machine. The truth? It really happened. In the 1960s, the government hired a university professor to develop a way to detect homosexuality in federal employees. He came up with a machine that measured pupil dilation in response to same-sex erotic imagery. The Canadian government used it to exclude or fire more than 400 men from civil service, the military, and the Mounties. Second, there is alien evidence in the American Southwest. Conspiracy. E.T. is buried in the desert of New Mexico. The truth. This one is real. Sort of. The Atari video game E.T., the extraterrestrial, failed so miserably that the company buried unsold cartridges in a desert landfill. Wait. Did you think I meant like real aliens in New Mexico? Not yet, anyway. And okay, this one I had fun with you on, so please don't throw things at me in chat. Third, Big Tobacco knew that cigarettes caused cancer. Conspiracy. For decades, tobacco companies buried evidence that smoking is potentially deadly. The truth. At the beginning of the 50s, research was showing an indisputable statistical link between smoking and lung cancer, but it wasn't until the late 90s that Philip Morris even admitted that smoking could cause cancer. Fourth, fake battle, real war. Conspiracy. The Gulf of Tonkin incident on August 2, 1964 was faked to provoke American support for the Vietnam War. The truth. By the time news reached American ears, the facts surrounding the North Vietnamese attack on the American naval ship Maddox were already fuzzy. Declassified intelligence documents have since revealed that the Maddox had provided support for South Vietnamese attacks on a nearby island and that the North Vietnamese were responding in kind, according to the U.S. Naval Institute. The event opened the floodgates for direct American military involvement in Vietnam. Number five, the government is spying on you. Conspiracy. With the advances in technology, the government is using its vast resources to track citizens. The truth. In 2016 alone, government agencies sent 49,868 requests for user data to Facebook, 27,850 to Google, and 9,076 to Apple, according to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Number six, John Lennon was under government surveillance. Conspiracy. The FBI was spying on former Beatle John Lennon. The truth. They most certainly were. Like many counterculture heroes, Lennon was considered a threat. Anti-war songs like Give Peace a Chance didn't exactly endear former Beatle John Lennon to the Nixon administration, NPR reported in 2010. In 1971, the FBI put Lennon under surveillance, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service tried to deport him a year later. Number seven, the Dalai Lama. Conspiracy. The Dalai Lama is a CIA agent. The truth. Perhaps the reason the Dalai Lama is smiling in all the photos you see him in has something to do with the six-figure salary he pulled down from the United States government during the 1960s. According to declassified intelligence documents, he earned $180,000 in connection with the CIA's funding of the Tibetan resistance to the tune of $1.7 million per year. The idea was to disrupt and hamper China's infrastructure. Eighth, bad booze. Conspiracy. During Prohibition, the government poisoned alcohol to keep people from drinking. The truth. Manufacturers of industrial alcohol had been mixing their product with dangerous chemicals for years prior to Prohibition. But between 26 and 33, the federal government pushed manufacturers to use stronger poisons to discourage bootleggers from turning the alcohol into moonshine. Now, that didn't necessarily stop the bootleggers or their customers, and by the end of Prohibition, more than 10,000 Americans had been killed by tainted booze. And lastly, number 9. Project Sunshine. Conspiracy. The government was stealing dead bodies to do radioactive testing. The truth. The government was stealing parts of dead bodies because they needed young tissue. They recruited a worldwide network of agents to find recently deceased babies and children and then take samples and even limbs, each collected without notification or permission of the more than 1,500 grieving families. So yes, people were laughing at or laughed at for saying what they said about Project Sunshine, the Dalai Lama, John Lennon, and more. It's not uncommon to laugh at ancient astronaut theorists. It's not uncommon to laugh at people that say the government is against you. Far too often, as presented by Dr. May in his book, Pseudoscience and Science, culture, whether books, magazine articles, TVs, movies, and the like, largely impacted people in the UFO and other landscape. He does not apply the same, from what I can tell, to the individuals of news or governments. The thing is, we are just simply humans. Well, most of you are. We are influenced by everything around us. Who here cannot see a corgi and think of Sam? See a Circle K? You're probably going to get a chuckle and think of Ordy. See bad movies? You're probably thinking of Brad and Paul. There are many that get stuck in their ways, disregarding anything someone who does not think like we do as poo-poo or sheer evil. There is nothing wrong with a good conspiracy theory. In fact, anything that makes you stop and think is good. One of the main themes of a fair number of my shows have been what if. We become a better species by stopping and thinking about things from a completely different perspective from time to time. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. I truly appreciate it. You can find me at Stoner Brewing Co. on Twitter. Catch me next Sunday at this time for The Lost Wanderer, the new show about space and science. Stay tuned for Al and Ray with Circumspice, the right side of Michigan. Don't forget to tune in to KLRN Radio, America's podcast network, Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern for FUBAR, with, I believe, Politibunny coming back and that Amish fellow. And then stay tuned for Cyberchill, also with the Amish fellow in Lou. I am JEFF. This is In the Crease. Namaste, good night, friends, and don't panic.